Dr. Michael Roizen.
Dr. Michael Roizen.
You, the Owner's Manual Radio Show.
You're listening to You, the Owner's Manual Radio Podcast on iHeart or Radio MD, wherever you download us from. Thank you for doing that. We have a special guest today, a good friend, Dr. Mehmet Oz, who people call the administrator of CMS, which I'm going to find out what all that he does in a day. But his days are not normally the normal days. That is, I've known Mehmet for, I think, about 24 years now. His days are probably 14 to 20-hour days. He is not an administrator. He's actually a leader. I've watched this. He's probably one of the most innovative and fast-learning persons I've ever met. So I'm proud to have him on. And he's on because there's a special birthday. Medicare is turning 60 today. It's July 30th, 2025. Dr. Oz, what has Medicare done in these last 60 years?
Well, Mike, thank you very much for having me on. This is a important milestone for the country. This Medicare and Medicaid program, which has been in existence for 60 years, has become the backbone of our social safety net in America. It's a shining example of how we can do things right in the federal government. And 60 years ago, when it was signed into law today by Lyndon Johnson, remember, Lyndon Johnson became president when JFK was assassinated. He'd won re-election with this belief that he could create a great society. And he'd been influenced by Harry S. Truman, who had been the president at the end of the Second World War and had tried to create a mechanism to provide health insurance to seniors. There wasn't the belief it needed to happen for able-bodied individuals. They would go off and work in the workplace and earn commercial health insurance. But for seniors, people who are in those days not living that much longer than age 65, in life expectancy, I think, was around 67. They thought, why don't we just give them health insurance to cover them, especially because as you get older, it gets expensive, your illnesses become more chronic. And so he signed into law this bill with patient number one being Harry S. Truman. His predecessor was the first patient on Medicare. They were watched by their wives. And the other person who was in the room when they were signing the bill was Hubert Humphrey. Now, I'm in the Humphrey building right now. The Humphrey Building is the Health and Human Services Building. It's where Secretary Kennedy presides. And as you walk into the building, to the left, there's a beautiful marble plaque that has this quote from Hubert Humphrey. It says, the moral obligation of government is to take care of people at the dawn of their life, the children, those at the twilight of their life, the seniors, and those who are living in the shadows. It's a haunting use of light imagery to talk about people who are vulnerable. And that is, at its very core, what Medicare and Medicaid sought to do. They were both created at the same time. They both came out of the Social Security Act. The essence of it was, if you've fallen and you need a hand up, we're here for you. If you're destitute, or you're a child born into poverty, which today 53% of kids are in that category, or they get CHIP health insurance, children's health insurance. If you're a senior who's having health issues, we're going to provide coverage for you. And the rest of the country will chip in and make sure that comes to fruition. And it's delivered on that promise for 60 years.
There have been a lot of innovations in Medicare that have caused innovations across the country. One of the worries is Medicare is 60, and we worry about its trust fund being diminished or being, if you will, ending in some way by 2033, I think, according to the trustees, and causing what I call the aging of Medicare, the disability of Medicare. So I like to use age, as you know, as a model. And like the rest of the country, the average age of American developing a disability is the same, 67. So I want to make America younger as well as keep Medicare younger. And I think some of the innovations that have happened, such as the Welcome to Medicare Wellness Program and Silver Sneakers, have really done a job in helping the rest of us stay younger.
You mentioned the trust fund. It's what pays for the hospital component of Medicare. And it's funded by everybody who's hearing my voice right now, chipping in 2.9% of their paycheck throughout their life. You may not realize it, but there's 2.9% missing. Sometimes your employer pays half of it. And it goes to contributing to the hospital care of people on Medicare. That money, the part of the Medicare Trust Fund is going to be depleted, aka bankrupt, by 2033. In some scenarios, it'll go bankrupt faster. And I bring that up, as you highlighted, Mike, because to protect this precious program, we have to make sure we spend our money wisely. If we use money for inefficient services, if we are unable to allow the healthcare system to become more productive, if we don't free it from some of the restraints of regulation so that it can actually be the program that it needs to be for all Americans, then we're going to condemn it to being depleted or bankrupt and hurt people who should have been helped afterwards. The downside, of course, of it being depleted is you have to pour a ton of money in to save it, which means future generations are going to have to pay higher taxes. So I think the wise thing for us to do is make the system more efficient today. And by doing that, allow us to still deliver care, but high quality care. And Mike, I should point out something you know, but listeners might not, which is the number three cause of death in America is a health error. That's unfortunate, obviously, but it's also, to me anyway, unforgivable if we're spending twice as much as any other country per capita on healthcare. So we're spending all this money, and yet we don't seem to get the quality all the time that we deserve.
Talk a little bit about what you think is some of the major innovations. You spoke about when we started it, believe it or not, you know, I was a medical student in that era when Medicare came in. You're a little younger, so you weren't there, but we all volunteered, you know, all the physicians in the community volunteered 20% of their time, one day a week at the community hospitals, which were largely supported by the big cities and the communities and some of the charities, et cetera. And this was difficult to get access. I mean, people who were elderly had largely came to the community hospitals, if you will, and there was a long, long waiting lines. And we had we think today's access is difficult. You should have seen it back in that era. So Medicare really changed that dramatically.
Medicare brought a sense of stability, of security, of love into the system. You didn't have to do it as a favor anymore. You could actually get some compensation for the care you were giving to seniors. And remember, it was also for people who had renal failure and other disabilities. So it was folks who had problems that fit into this special category. It also sort of set a standard that there'd be some money, but not a ton of money. So you don't overpay on Medicare. Medicare tends to pay less than commercial health insurance, which again, the big companies you all know of, the private companies that work with the employers. So it's understood that people who can work and are in the workforce will pay a little bit more, significantly more than people on Medicare. It was a safety net program. And that's how it's worked and stayed intact. Now, interestingly, as the administrator of the program, I'll speak to the fact that it's not just how we dole the money out, but what we incentivize by spending this money. So what lever arms do you turn on? What do you catalyze? Do you get patients to care more about their health? Do you get doctors to learn about new ways of providing care? Do you quality control and the services that hospitals provide? What are the other things you can get going? Because you do it at a national level. And we're spending, you know, $800 billion a year on Medicare, another $800 billion in Medicaid and Medicare, each about that much money. So it's a lot of money that you get to put into the systems. You might as well get people to act in ways that are conducive to the system getting better. We also, for that reason, often set the standards for what the commercial health insurance companies will do. They'll often pay for what we pay for.
And I think that's a strong innovation because you've made what I would call over the years wise decisions on the drugs and drug program. And that's actually another innovation that as drugs got both more innovative and more expensive, Medicare has done an awful lot to offset the costs of those and the design of those.
Well, one of the examples that I often point to of how we've done things right in the federal government, and again, this is the best job I've ever had, Mike. I adore the people I work with. You have the ability to meet with really smart people all day long, the private sector, community groups, patient groups. But you also can look at some of the successes we've had. And getting the drugs that are quite expensive paid for by Medicare has allowed us to negotiate those prices because you're buying in bulk. And so you negotiate prices that are, we think, more equitable. And for that reason, seniors who are often strapped, they can't afford the drug prices. Now they can. We provide extra support when necessary. We get the drug companies to chip in more money when the dollars don't quite add up. And it's been a success story. The government estimates what programs will cost. And they estimated that this medication coverage in Medicare would be a very, very expensive process. And it is expensive, but not nearly what they thought it was going
to
be.
So are you able to negotiate? In other words, there was a law where you negotiate the top 10. Are you able to negotiate more, or is there changes coming to be able to negotiate more of that?
So it's called the IRA, this law, and we negotiated 10 drugs last year. The top selling drugs you can negotiate. So this year we're doing the next top 15 drugs, and every year 15 more drugs. And there's some restrictions around which drugs you can negotiate on. And of course, we want to have medications available to people. We want the pricing to be more reasonable. Then we think there's good arguments for the drugs that we negotiate every year. And over time, of course, if you take the top 15 drugs every year that are the most popular in America, they'll get replaced by other drugs, but keep up generally with the amount of money that the taxpayers have to pay for seniors to get these drugs.
Now, I've learned that one of the most expensive processes or diseases is macular degeneration treatments. Have I learned correctly? Is that a very expensive process?
It's expensive for a couple of reasons. There are treatments. They're not perfect. And so you have a condition that can lead to blindness, and people don't want to have that problem. So they'll do what's required to avoid it. But that tends to be expensive. There are other more expensive conditions. Things like sickle cell anemia are very expensive, but you're curing the problem. This is one important distinction. Paying a lot of money to tread water on a chronic condition is not generally as effective as curing the problem with a single shot. Even if the single shot's expensive, it's a one-time intervention and you're done. In terms of the country's well-being, if I can take a child with sickle cell anemia and help them avoid the pain and the suffering that goes along with that ailment by treating their genetic defect, that's a pretty good return on investment.
I should tell you, on the A segment, we do an A and a B segment of this podcast every week. On the A segment last week, I presented the new research of Jennifer Duda from the Gladstone, who thinks she can reduce the cost of, for example, sickle cell genetic treatment, the cure, if you will, 2,000-fold. She's working on, I think she formed a new company to do this. Obviously, Jennifer Duda is the one who got the Nobel Prize, or one of the two winners of the Nobel Prize in 2012 for CRISPR-Cas9 and the gene editing process. She thinks they will be able to reduce it from $1.2 to $2 million a treatment to under $1,000.
Yeah, I tell you, Mike, those are the kind of advances that they give me goosebumps, because we want to fund these therapies even though they're expensive, but it does put taxpayers in a pickle, and states often have a tough time affording this. But listen, I'm getting called back to go save lives in the Medicare building. I want to thank you for taking time to talk about our 60th birthday. You've been a wonderful friend. As you point out, 24 years. I stopped counting after the first two decades because it's so much fun being with you. I applaud you for all your success. Thanks for leading the way at the Cleveland Clinic. And for everyone out there, I just want you to remember how important programs like Medicare and Medicaid are. Treasure them. They are crown jewels. And God bless you for letting me part of this. Take care, Mike.